Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hi everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's great to have you company for another episode of our show. Now today we're talking about a really important topic, and that is how to scale up. And when you scale up, you're creating a business as compared to a job or a self-employed situation. And when you scale up, you tend to make more money, you have more free time, and ultimately you have a business rather than a job. My guest today owns a couple of practices in Victoria, and I'm talking about Dr. Vandana Boudoir. And she's going to be sharing some of the insights and experiences she's had on that scaling journey. Now, in particular, she's going to talk about the first practice that she bought, how she was able to radically and exponentially grow that, building on the good foundations that came when she bought the practice. She's also going to share a bit about a practice that she bought but later sold because it wasn't the right kind of practice for her. And we talk about the difference between a practice that is geared up to be a business versus a practice that is geared up to be a self-employed or job for the owner-operator dentist and the distinctions and differences between the two. We'll then talk about a different practice again that she bought and how she was able to grow and scale that as well. And so this is a really interesting conversation. She's going to talk about how she's built her team, how she's trained her team, what sort of systems are in place. And she's going to talk about the three key metrics for success, which are really, really important. Three key factors that allow some people to achieve a lot while others only achieve a modest amount. And then she talks about that right at the very end. So make sure you stay tuned. Now, this is a blueprint for scaling. This is a masterclass in how to grow an organization that thrives without your direct input. So if you want to grow a business that can operate without you, if you want to have a practice that gives you more money, more time, more freedom, this is the episode that you're going to want to tune into because there's so many good points that Vandana shares with you. So without any further ado, here's Dr. Vandana Boudoir. Vandana, thank you so much for taking the time to come and join us on the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's great to have your company. How's things with you?
Things are great. First of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting me. Believe it or not, I know you've got 400 plus episodes on your podcast. I listen to them when I do my running or cycling in the gym.
Oh, wow.
So I've listened to most of them. And what I like about it is you've got a mix. You've got a mix of business owners. You've got lots of sports people, which I really, really like because I think they have discipline, which we can always translate into a lot of factors in our lives. You've got a lot of things about culture, which is always used to be a bugbear and is getting better, I'd like to say. And I've taken a lot of lessons on. The podcasts were the reason I got into the Practice Max program as well, because there was so much value. I knew that was just a snapshot of what I could gain from it. So I have listened to the bulk of them.
Oh, thank you. That's really kind of you. I know where my one listener is now, so thank you. No, I'm joking. Vandana, you've just articulated, I've been really grateful to have had the opportunity to work alongside you and Rohit now for a little while. And the reason I wanted to invite you onto this podcast is because, you know, you do things really well. You've got a great multiple practices. I'm aware that you're on a rapid growth trajectory. You've built great teams, great culture. And it's been really from the outside, you know, looking in and having a, you know, being able to look behind the curtain a bit, there's a lot that's to admire about your practice. And I wanted to take a moment today, if we could, to unpack some of those things. And I guess one of the things I always like to start the conversation with is you've got, you know, several practices now, but I want to go back to the early days when you had your first practice and you're probably new to practice ownership. What was that experience like for you? What did it look like? What were the common challenges that you were experiencing at the time?
So next year is my 10th year of practice ownership.
Oh, wow.
So my practice is now 10 years old. It's mature. And this is the first time we've actually taken, because it's so mature and it's so it's a beautiful, lovely practice, which I have no concerns with. Obviously, there's always little problems here and there, but overall, it's the practice that has never given me significant amounts of grief. Mm. As a reward for everyone, we are taking 3 weeks off in that practice. So
nice.
It closes on this Friday and we all come back on the 8th of January. So there's no, it's a wonderful feeling. It's liberating, so to speak, that I don't have to worry about it on a day-to-day basis. When we bought this practice, I think the strategic, this was back in 2014. And the reason I started to look into practice ownership was because of the place I've had really good employers. I've only had two in my life. That's mm-hmm. it. And one of them became my business partner for about 3 to 5 years going on into practice ownership. And the other one was a beautiful lady who gave me so much freedom in my practice that I was able to do everything I wanted to clinically. But more than that, she left me in charge of running a satellite practice that she had in the western suburbs of Melbourne. Mm. So I was almost running that practice, so to speak. And she would touch base with me occasionally and say that you are producing a significant amount of profit. So that was, it was good feedback. It let me know that I could achieve something just by myself in a single chair practice in a suburb called Point Cook, where there's 11 other practices around the area.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
It was very heartening.
Yeah.
And that led me to think that, look, I think I can do it on my own. I did not, having said that, because she had another single chair practice, that was not a journey I wanted to take because it meant that I would be tied to that practice and I wanted a business. I was very clear about that from the outset. My kids, I had one child at the time and I did want to spend time with him. So before I even went into practice ownership, I had a clear goal. I wanted to work 3 days clinically, yeah. and that would be the end point. I wanted at least two chairs in my practice with the ability to scale it. I wanted it to be in the outskirts of Melbourne, not in a competitive area, mm-hmm. with the opportunity for significant amounts of bread and butter dentistry. I engaged the services of Simon Palmer from mm-hmm. Practice Research, and I gave him my brief. We went through multiple viewings, and we lost out on some of the practices we thought would be a good fit. Mm-hmm. And finally, we settled onto this practice in Wonthaggi. It is about 90 minutes from the CBD of Melbourne. It's in a regional or a rural town. And it was a part of a... it's a part of the miners' dispensary. So back in the day, Wonthaggi was a coal mining town.
Yes.
And the practice was set up in collaboration with the pharmacist and the dentist to provide services to the community because the bulk of the community was a coal mining community. As a result, we almost had the ability to step into a database which would never decline. There was competition. There's always competition, but it was quite low. And it was also the ability to scale up because we were busy from day one.
Mm.
I think we had about the practice at the time was turning over $750,000 a year.
Yep.
But the biggest thing was that I worked 3 days a week. We hired an associate immediately. Mm-hmm. He's still with us.
Oh, great.
My business partner at the time worked for 2 days a week. And in the second month, we actually made a profit. So I haven't had any other practice since then.
Well, that's great. That's fantastic. So there's a lot in there that I'd love to unpack. You were very specific about wanting a business. And
correct.
So that's really interesting because not everyone gets to that point at the outset. Some people kind of realize that after mm-hmm. they've been, you know, hands in mouth for so long and they're getting tired and burned out. But you had the prescience and the foresight to know what you wanted, which I think is fantastic. And I always wanted that too. I'm curious to ask you how that thought process evolved in your mind about mm-hmm. having a business versus, I guess, having a job by comparison.
Okay. So the reason why I got into, there's a lot of people who don't know about this, but there's a part of, and it'll weave into the story, but Rohit used to work for the NAB at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And as he started out working in, it was to do with banking,
mm-hmm.
And the hours were very long. So he used to work 60 to 80 hours a week.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes sleeping in the office, which a lot of bankers do. They used to do at the time. I think they don't do anymore, but wow. That was the case. So when my son was born, it was almost like he missed out on the full first year of his life.
Oh, gosh.
And he then sort of sat down and thought that, look, this cannot continue health-wise, family-wise, et cetera, et cetera. So he changed his role within the organization and he sidestepped into a role which was to allow him to go into the businesses in NAB which were not working well, mm-hmm. and try and turn them around. So yeah. there were the small businesses that weren't. I don't know if that service works anymore, but it was that at the time.
Yeah.
That was very, very good, or fortuitous, so to speak, because he would come home and he would talk about the businesses that were succeeding really well, sort of a broad overview,
yeah.
more than anything. That made us realize that there was an opportunity to build a business as opposed to just getting into a practice and being a self-employed dentist. There's nothing wrong with that.
No.
I admire people who do that. I wish I was one of them. It's a much simpler way of doing things.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, obviously we saw that there was potential in having a business and the challenges of growing a business, which allowed you the freedom to be able to step away from the tools. Mm. It also meant that you could clinically work 2 or 3 days a week. You could spend some time from home on admin, mm-hmm. and you could take a little bit of time off without having that considerable dip in the income. He's also very conservative, as you would know already from whatever number of times. He's very conservative, and that helped us with COVID. That helps us a lot. But his cash flow projections are a nightmare. So anytime there's a cash flow issue, he stresses out a lot. So for us, that was for him, so to speak, it was very important that there would be an income coming in, regardless of whether I was clinically working, felt like clinically working, or I could clinically work. He's also very insurance driven. So he always thought, you know, what if she breaks a leg, or what if, you know, you, for whatever reason, you can't work, you know, there's illness, there's family that needs to be looked after. So there has to be, that was the thought of going into business, as opposed to looking at a practice close by the house where I could work day in and day out and still produce an income.
It's really interesting, because what I'm hearing is Rohit is also very mindful of risk and risk management.
Yes, externally sometimes.
Yeah,
yes.
And he's quite conservative with his projections. And that probably, I guess, adds a layer of safety for your business as well, that perhaps someone less conservative might not have. But I'm a big believer in safety, and I'm a big believer in having margins of safety probably beyond what's needed. I probably err on the Rohit side of the spectrum a bit there. With that first practice, what do you think you did really well in those early days? What do you think allowed that practice to grow so well? And I'm interested to know that your associate that you had back then is still with you today. So again, something's working very well in that practice. What do you think it is?
So the practice is in a slightly lower socioeconomic area.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that we saw was that there was a significant number of people with large amalgam fillings that had been patched over and over again. At the time, they were used to redos.
Yeah.
So to speak. So, and there was not a lot of technology in the practice. It was an old practice. Impressions were still being done they're still being done by hand in some practices, but the impressions were still analog.
Mm.
The only piece of technology we had at the time was rotary endodontics,
mm-hmm.
and digital x-rays. Everything else was quite just the run-of-the-mill basic dental practice. The first thing we did was we realized that there is a significant amount of need for indirect restorations, full coverage restorations, because 90% of our work was repairing or redoing the silver fillings.
Mm-hmm.
And not everyone was keen on a $2,000 crown. So we invested in a CEREC machine, mm-hmm. after a lot of thought. The associate loved it. From day one, he's a very technical guy. It was almost his baby more than mine. And we gave him all the CEREX he could have, mm-hmm. because he really enjoyed it. But we also bought the fees down for our CEREC. Our CEREC rounds at the time were $1,600, including a core. So that meant that I'm not saying we were undercutting anybody, but we were able to offer a service at a price that was quite palatable to the broader community. There was a need for it. And it also kept our associate associates, which we added on progressively, quite busy, because they felt engaged. 1 or 2 CERECs a day. I mean, I know people talk about significant sums of money, but for me, any associate that's billing 3,000 days $3,000 a day is doing quite well. And they hit that target quite easily. They had a CEREC in the morning. They had some exams in the afternoon. They had an insert. So we devised a workflow that worked with everybody. So we did not do, you know, make the patient sit in the waiting room. None of that. We would do the CEREC was done the first thing in the morning. We gave ourselves a full-on buffer because the technology often fails.
Yes.
Insert was either the following day or at the end of the day. Progressively, that was a huge shift. It made the days go really busy. It meant we were able to add more associates on, and the revenue increased substantially. So from a practice that was making $2,000 to $3,000 a day, it jumped straight up to $8,000 a day. That is a big jump. So Crown and Bridge introduced, that was a big jump. The second jump came with implant dentistry. So I enrolled into implant dentistry, got into full arch work, and that increased the revenue. But as we got into practice ownership, there was a simple outline that we had that we would provide quality dentistry at reasonable prices. Mm. So the CEREC's was still done under rubber dam. We still used really good products like Ivoclar. There were very minimal redos, if any. So the reputation then started to spread in the community that if you travel, because a lot of people traveled, that if you travel for the full day, your work is done comprehensively, but you don't have to go back again because something doesn't work. So that was the two key things that we introduced, quality work and fixed crown and bridge.
The thing that I really love about that is it's simple but incredibly effective, and it's very well thought out, and the results obviously speak for themselves. And obviously that associate who took ownership of the CEREC has enjoyed that journey as well. What was the impetus to look at a second practice?
So the second practice, I wouldn't call it a success. It was actually a very big learning curve for us. So we lived in Hawthorne at the time, and we've always lived in Hawthorne and we still live there. But my son goes to school in Hawthorne and he loves the school. The school loves him. So we thought, you know, I'll buy a practice closer to the house. Mm-hmm. And that was in the same year. I think we probably got cocky that the practice was doing really well and we can replicate this in another practice. So this practice we bought was in Malvern. Malvern is a very affluent area.
Yes.
The practice did not have any... it wasn't a digital practice. It still was a paper card practice. Mm-hmm. And the owner had been there. So that practice had been serving Melbourne since 1903.
Oh, wow.
So on paper, it looked beautiful. It was a father, then a son, and then the doctor that we were working with. So it had, in the span of 110 years, it only had three owners. Mm. However, I think the issue was that because it was a self-employed dentist who always worked in that area, the database wasn't significant. And there was not much of a need because being an affluent area, these were lawyers, these were doctors who've been attending practice years on years. So all they needed in terms of work was two bite wings every 2 years and a check and clean at the most. The dentist had also been doing patchwork for the last 30, 40 years, which meant that they were not used to comprehensive dentistry. Mm-hmm. So we were breaking even, but we weren't growing, and we weren't growing beyond a single chair. So it was never going to be a business, as so to speak. Mm. So after, you know, persevering for over 2 years, we decided to sell that practice.
Okay.
We sold it, but we also, before we sold it, we bought Ballarat, which is probably my biggest success story so far. Ballarat was bought at the time where I was finishing up my post-diploma at the University of Melbourne. Mm-hmm. We found that regional practices probably work a bit better. Mm. There is hard work involved, obviously, getting up at 6 o'clock, going to the practice, being there at 8 o'clock, having a longer day. But it also came with the books are always busy. So it gave me that comfort. I'd rather travel 3 hours than have an empty book.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So that was, so we decided to replicate the same story. We thought, you know, before we decide to get rid of Malvern, let's look at another practice. Mm-hmm. And Ballarat was an area that we kind of had looked at multiple times. Mm. because it's still a city. It was still within the 90-minute radius. It still had similarish demographics to Wonthaggi, probably a bit better because it was a gold mining town as opposed to a coal mining town.
Yep.
And that's how we looked at the practice. We bought this practice in 2017. Mm-hmm. And then we sold Malvern through Simon Palmer, only purely because it was always going to be a self-employed practice. It was, for someone else, it was a perfect practice. You could drop your child to school, go practice on 8 patients a day, go back, pick them up, but it wasn't for me.
So that's really interesting, because what we've just identified is when you buy a practice, not all practices are going to be suitable for business ownership versus self-employment. So you've articulated a couple of lessons and learnings there. And because you were clear about business ownership being your outcome, but buying the practice in Malvern was, you know, one chair, you know, single operator, hadn't really grown the database because there was no need to, because it had been operated by one person for such a long period of time. When you bought the practice in Ballarat, I'm assuming, again, it had different characteristics again. So just for clarity, what were the characteristics that you identified in Ballarat that were missing in Malvern?
So Ballarat was a 5-chair practice.
Mm-hmm.
It always had associates or therapists. It was run by a husband and a wife dentist team who did really good dentistry. They still do.
Yeah.
So the practice was built with a fair bit of, it's very aesthetically built. It was built with the purposes of expansion. There was a lot of room in it. Mm-hmm. And it had all the technology we needed,
yes,
except for the CBCT. It had pretty much every single thing. So at the moment I saw the practice, I knew that there was obviously, it was probably the biggest risk that I've taken. I had to promise Rohit that I would do anything to get this through the line, because it was, I think we bought it for about 1.4 million, which is a fair bit of money to buy a practice, which was billing about 1.6, 1.7. So it was one for one, so to speak.
Yep.
And the dentists had been in the community for a very long time. So it wasn't, I knew going into it, it wasn't going to be easy.
Mm-hmm.
But by that time, due to circumstances, Wonthaggi was well and truly independent.
Yes.
A significant number of loans had been paid off.
Yes.
It was turning up a profit.
So you had confidence in
that? I had confidence.
Yeah.
I have confidence. So it was matured to a stage where it was always busy enough. We had associates, we had staff. So that was the time we decided to take on this venture, which was 5 years later, probably the best decision that I took. 2 years ago, I wasn't convinced about it till 2020, though. It was quite difficult.
Was that the pandemic that made you feel comfortable?
No. Yes, that is correct. The pandemic turned it around for me.
Okay.
So,
was that because of population migration out of the Melbourne into Ballarat? Is that what drove
it? That is correct, yes. So
I'm curious to ask, Vanda, you've got a practice in Wonthaggi, you've got a practice in Ballarat, and you live in Hawthorne.
Correct.
All right. So what sort of team structures, management structures do you have in place at each location, and how do you remain across the practices, what's happening, without being in? Because I guess what I'm trying to talk about is how do you be involved but not kind of entrenched?
Correct, yes. So with Wonthaggi, we have one receptionist,
mm-hmm.
Which is a receptionist that is purely reception.
Yep.
We have 5 other staff who are all cross-trained.
Yes.
So they're all cross-trained to do both reception and nursing. It's a regional town. Staffing is hard if everyone's not cross-trained.
Yes.
So at any point in time, you will have 2 people manning the reception. One of them is a DA. So if someone is sick, they can take over. They can help with the outflow of steri, etc. So we have 3 chairs running. There was a time that we had drawn the line at 3 chairs, but because it's, again, matured and I've got mature staff, I'm thinking about adding a theater there.
Yeah.
So the structure there is that I do have a core member who's not necessarily the practice manager or the receptionist, but they're more the leaders and the trainers. So if any person comes in, there is a 4-week training program that they have to go through, which I have taught these girls about 4 years ago. So they follow it to the letter. So that is the first week you do this. This is the second week. This is the third week. This is the fourth week. They also communicate with us quite regularly. And we've also introduced something called the huddle there. So every morning there is a huddle that is, which we actually took away from your practice max sessions, to be honest, from the group discussions.
Yep.
So the huddle is undertaken by either the receptionist or one of the senior DAs. The huddle is then communicated via a WhatsApp group to everybody involved. One thing that sets that practice apart is my senior dentist, who's been there for 10 years, actually takes a lot of interest.
Yeah.
Which not a lot of associates do. If there is anything that is amiss, he lets me know. But in a very subtle manner, he's also happy to talk to the staff if there's something in particular he wants. He's one of the dentists who, obviously, because of the relationship we have with him, he gets what he wants. It can be a prime scan. It can be the most expensive material, but he's earned that right. In return, as I said, he is very, very, he has taken some. So we have got a clinical ownership there.
Yes.
But in the Michael, we have some ownership in the clinical auxiliary staff by means of my really older DAs. And we have some clinical ownership at reception by means of my treatment coordinator. We do not have a practice manager as such there. It would be really nice to have one, but I haven't found the right person. So,
maybe in time. Yeah.
That is the right.
So, I just want to ask you a couple of questions about that, because a couple of really juicy bits of information there. One was the onboarding process and the role of cross-training. How important is your onboarding? Again, 4 weeks probably sounds like a lot to some people, but I think that that's actually really great. What prompted you to think 4 weeks? What's specifically involved? What's the outcome? Like at the end of 4 weeks, what's that person achieved? What can they do? What values and beliefs do they hold? All those sorts of things.
So obviously we have a 4-week training program for a receptionist as well as a 4-week training program for a DA.
Yep.
When we do the interviews, we make it very clear to all the dental assistants that there will be some element of nursing.
Yes.
Most of it will be nursing, but there will be some element of reception.
Yes.
But that reception training for a DA is pretty much, it is within boundaries of taking payments, making appointments, doing DLC calls, etc. So it's a pretty smaller role that they play.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, with the receptionist training, the training is done on site. Oh, thankfully, we haven't had to do that many in the last so many years, but it's done on site by Rohit and by myself.
Yep.
Just because that is the receptionist is the person who can make or break our businesses. So I'd like to have that involvement for the first few weeks. The DA training has been completely outsourced to my senior staff members. And how we train them is a DA at the end of first week, she should be able to, she should know what is the mission statement of the practice, which is quite simple.
Yep.
And that it's not cluttered. So we do quality work at fairly reasonable prices. And we take patients of every age and every stage.
Yep.
That's it. It's not complicated at all. By the end of the week, they need to know they need to understand that they need to be able to do steri. They need to do a good standard, which is also examined by one of the staff members.
Mm-hmm.
And they should be able to articulate tray setups. They don't have to necessarily be able to do it, but they need to be articulating that. The second week is when they start to get their hands a little bit dirty. And then the whole week, they are repeating suction for a scale and clean procedure.
Yeah.
So we find anybody and everybody in the practice, but it's repeated till their muscle memory sets in.
Yep.
The third week, they do it for any restorative setups. And we keep repeating it till muscle memory sets up again. And the fourth week is then culmination of the training, when they need to understand that different trays are needed for different setups. What's the importance of having a daily huddle? What's the importance of setting up your trays the night before? And then they get examined on another tray setup, another scale and clean, another restorative setup, and then we call it a day. Then from that fifth week onwards, they are now rostered on without a supervisor. Up until the 4 weeks, there's someone supervising them.
Yep.
That fifth week onwards, they don't have a supervisor as such. And that's where they then get skilled up further as their interests are for crown and bridge, for extractions, for implant procedures, and so on and so forth.
For the listeners, let me just chunk that into some pieces, just so that's a process and conceptual there. So, Vanda, some absolute pearls, some really good gold in that. So, ladies and gents, if you're thinking about this, there's a couple of key things. One is what Vandana has done is to set her practices up to become training institutions, so very good at training. Some of that training is done in-house, or it's all done in-house. Some of it's been done by Vandana and Rohit directly, others by a lead trainer in the practice. So, again, the who, not how question, you know, who can do this for us? What I think is really impressive, though, is A, the repetition, because repetition is the mother of skill, the muscle memory that Vandana spoke about. So doing the reps, basically, getting that built. And the third thing there is having the buddy system, so that the for the first 4 weeks, the new team member is accompanied by someone else who's looking over their shoulder. And finally, it's about actually testing. And it's about making sure that the standards that are, you know, being set are being achieved. And that means that we've got the right things being done the right way consistently over time. So again, Vandana, I think there's some absolute pearls of wisdom in that. So thank you for sharing that. I wanted to ask you just as well, because I did start by saying, well, you're in Hawthorne and you've got these two practices far away. One of the things that I'm always interested in as well is how, as the practice owner, do you measure results? What dashboards, what metrics, what reports come back to you? Because one of the things we know, if you're going to create leverage, one of the tools around leverage is having good reporting, having adequate reporting, so you've got information from which to make good decisions. What reports do you and Rohit get, and what frequency do they come?
So with the reporting, so the thing is with the associates, because obviously the clinicians are the ones who are going to bring the dollars in. So before we even ask them about anything, at the interview stage, we tell them that we do have some key performance indicators that we are going to talk, and it's in the contract as well. The key performance indicators for them in the first 6 months are they need to have really, really good recall appointments, or so that's the key performance indicator for the first 6 months, that every patient that walks and sees them walks out of the door either with an appointment made or with a time that we will be ringing them to discuss about the future appointments.
Yeah.
And that needs to be about 80 to 90%. So that is in the contract. It's discussed, but it's not that they, here you go, this is how you do it. There is some training that's done. The second indicator is that there should be minimal transfer of records. So less than one or two a month in a regional practice, any more than that is probably something not right. If there is a record transfer, we also have a protocol for it, that the front office staff will identify the dentist about the record that's been transferred.
Yeah.
They will have a look at it. They will do their diagnostics, whether the patients move away, it's someone, et cetera, et cetera. Dentists are smart people. Once you tell them what they are looking for, they can do it themselves.
Yeah.
So they once they know what they're looking for, you find that the record transfer does, they take it quite seriously and they take ownership of it.
Yeah, right.
And the third and the final KPI is a 5-star review. So you want to have at least one or two 5-star reviews a week.
Yep.
They all exceed it.
Yep.
Maybe not, yeah. So I haven't had a single dentist in the last so many 2 or 3 years who hasn't really been able to do the first 6 months. At 6 months, we do start to talk about the revenue. I'm very clear about the revenue. So before we start, after the 6 months, I sit down with them and I tell them that, look, I'm not a practicing dentist except. So I have limited my dentistry to full arch dentist, full arch implant work. That's yep. it for the last 2 years. So it means that they get to do everything, which is, it's a good thing. Mm. But I tell them that with that, you know, the fact that you're able to do everything, you also have a little bit of a responsibility that you have to contribute to the overheads of the practice. I cannot do it all by myself. So this is the breakdown. This is the minimum amount of money that I need to keep your chair sustainable. Mm-hmm. As long as you're tracking well above this figure, you're golden.
Yeah.
Some people like talking about money and figures. Some people just absolutely hate it. They just don't want to know about it. Either way, I can work with them as long as they let me know what their preferences are. So at Ballarat, I've got three boys that just love the money, just love the figures so much that I have to sometimes tell them to calm down. And it's not about feelings, yeah. it's looking yeah. at the big picture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at the other side, I've got two dentists who have, one of them, in fact, she should be on Practice Max. So I've had her for 6 years now. And she's the best general dentist possible, but also her billings or her take home, whatever you call it, has not changed in the last 6 years by more than like $10 or $20. I have never seen such consistency in my life.
So she's just like metronomically producing what she produces.
Yes. And it's 5 years of 10, like within, sometimes it's within a few dollars.
Yep.
But no more than 10 or 20. So I think the fact that once they know what their overheads are, and we tell them, you know, this is, if you do a CEREC, it'll help you get to 50% of your target straight away. We will book in these appointments with you. When you're doing reviews, you do them like this. Don't look at the daily averages, look at the monthly figures. So there is a lot of training, appointment booking, all of that's given to them. Mm-hmm. And again, as I said, they are smart people and they always do the right thing by the patients, which I do keep an eye on. So if there is a dentist who's doing 3 or more crowns a day, I will go in and I'll have a look if they were really necessary as well. Because again, we are looking at the long term. You don't really want to sit there and do unnecessary treatment because it's all about good community growth as well.
Yeah, it's also just doing the right thing by the patients, right? Okay. So I think there's a lot in there. Now, again, really juicy conversation because I just want to bring up the topic of targets because you mentioned that some of your dentists love a target and others tend to shy away from it. But you mentioned that the ones that shy away from knowing about the numbers, you can still work with them. How do you work with those associates that kind of don't really want to think about the money or the target or whatever it is? Do you use a proxy? Do you use like an alternative target? Or how do you manage that?
I buddy them up.
Yeah.
I have learned this the hard way. It hasn't been the easy way. So we've had a few dentists that have not liked having targets. They don't want to discuss targets. They just don't. I mean, at the end of the day, regardless of whatever we say or do, dentistry is a business.
Yeah.
And we have to provide for our staff. We have to pay for the overheads, et cetera, et cetera. So if someone just doesn't want to work with you in that space, it's very hard to continue.
Yeah.
And it's there to, you know, with grace, just wow, you can say that relationship will not work. However, with the new grads, I find that when we talk to them while we are having contracts discussed and the KPIs discussed, we talk to them and we ask them, how do you feel about this reporting? How do you feel about discussing numbers and overheads, etc.? Some of them will come back, as I said, at this point in time, 5 or 6 of them have come back and said, look, I love it. Give it to me. I want to do it. Show me how to do it. Show me an exact, teach me XXY.
Yeah.
The one dentist we have at the moment who doesn't like it is actually now, it's not so much that he doesn't like it. He has an intense fear of not being able to do it.
Ah, okay.
So it's not so much the fact that he doesn't want to think about it. He doesn't want to fail at it.
Okay.
So the tools that we've given him are, first of all, we've buddied him up with another new grad.
Yep.
I catch up with him every Thursday to boost up their confidence. I will see a patient who needs full mouth work. It could be anything. It could be a patient that's come in for full arch implant work but doesn't necessarily need it. It probably can be done with some composites here and there, some orthodontics. So I'll do it to a certain point for him and then basically give him the planned case mm-hmm. and work with them. That builds up their confidence as well. So there's a few things that you have to do, but I think at this age and stage of my life, I can work with a lot of people
yeah.
and I can understand that everyone has something to contribute to. I think I'm not particularly choosy anymore. I kind of see the good in everybody.
I think that's a really good place to be as well, because I think if we can see the good in people and see that they're doing their best, and sometimes, you know, for whatever reason, you know, they've got their reasons for doing the things that they do is what I'm trying to say. And I really like that approach. I'm yet to meet the person who actually doesn't want to do their best. I think maybe someone somewhere, but most people are just trying to do the best they can. Vanda, I want to ask you about the role of clinical mentoring in your practice as well, and helping your dentists, particularly the younger dentists, expand their clinical repertoire and how to do more advanced treatment. Do you have a structured mm-hmm. mentoring program in place? Do you? Yeah, and if someone wanted to do, let's call it a more advanced treatment modality, whether it's ortho or implants or whatever, do you have specific training that they should do before they can do ortho or implants in your practice? What does it look like in your place?
We did not have structured mentoring for a while. And it's, I think, beyond that structured mentoring, you can't grow, because it's, there's only so much I can also do. Yeah. So what we've done is we've collaborated with Alex Kuminski, who I've known for a very long period of time, is now a friend more than a colleague. And he runs this GDR program quite well.
Yes.
So all of my associates, if they are new grads, they go through the GDR and I pay for it. So there's obviously contract details in there that they have to work for an X amount of years, which is not that significant. But they have to go through the GDR, and that GDR essentially gives them a cohort of networking. It gives them building blocks
yes.
to where I want them to be in a very structured manner. So that has been quite successful. Every year, I also will do... Twice a year, I have collaborated with Straumann
yep.
because I place a seriously large amount of implants. They come to the party and then they do a training program for all of my associates.
Great.
So because the fact is I am up, our practices are known for implant treatment. So the dentists who join us do have a keen interest.
Yes.
And I would like to, I would like them to do really good quality implant work. So that is an area that I want everyone to progress in. And they, at this point in time, they all want to. So they all get training on how to, so part of the training is done by myself. So I teach them how to diagnose, treatment plan, communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is obviously Straumann training, hands-on training on how to restore implants, how to, so that's given to all of them. Some choose not to take it, which is fine. And then we reiterate that same training in October. So they have the same training in February and then the same in October. And then we have in the middle, we have some clear correct training, which allows them, so we certify them for basic clear correct training, and we set them up with some orthodontists that we work with, namely Derek Mahoney,
mm-hmm.
So that they can discuss cases or refer cases and observe cases. So that's the bigger treatment plan, like the ortho, and so the bigger ortho and implant treatment. After that, once they get to a stage where they want to place implants, they have to go and do some sort of a diploma course.
Yes. Yeah.
So it could be either at the university, it could be Chris Ho, it could be MESAG. There's plenty around there who provide good quality education.
Yeah.
And that AIA, what they just need to do that. Then they can come back and place implants with me watching them for about the first 4 or 5 or even 10 implants if they choose to. What actually works really well in theory is also in practice is having a treatment coordinator in both the practices.
Yeah.
So what I found is they all want to do the treatment, but they can't communicate the treatment. And as we are getting into territory where it's, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, they completely fall down. So, and I don't want them to fall down. I want them to succeed. So once they've seen a patient, they've spoken to the patient, it's now time to go on from making this into this fantasy into a reality. Mm-hmm. And that's where our treatment coordinator steps in. Yeah. She will then make sure they've got all the records. She will make sure they've got all the data and they've got a brief treatment plan in place. Mm-hmm. They will then have a meeting with her in the office or whenever they've got a bit of time and explain to her that this is what they are planning to do. Her job is not to question them clinically. She knows that she will never do it. So the dentists are in charge, but sometimes if she sees something, you know, hey, have you discussed a Maryland hearing? She knows all of that.
Yeah,
sure. So she may make a suggestion here or there, but she will never she doesn't make the plan. She only understands the plan herself.
And communicates it, yeah.
And then she will ring the patients, call the patients, talk to the patients, make the appointments, discuss finance, super, TLC, the, you know, internal payment plans, et cetera, set it all up. Before the dentist has now started a bigger treatment plan, bulk of the times the payment's already being done.
Yeah.
So they are not taking that risk of, you know, am I going to get paid? Because we're also looking at lab fees. We're looking at implant componentry. We're looking at so many things that part is delegated. And I think that works really well, especially for younger dentists.
Yeah, I guess it lets them be the dentist without feeling the need to, you know, learn how to sell such big treatment. And having someone on hand who can do that. Vanda, I just want to shift gears for 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. Running these two practices, mm-hmm. what have you learned about yourself? What skills have you needed to develop?
So I had to, the first thing I had to develop was getting up early in the morning. I'm not a morning person. But having 2 regional practices, I think the latest I can get up is by 5:30. There is no way I can run them without getting up early. Yeah. So I have, it's made me a better person, a healthier person. Mm-hmm. So I get up at 5:30 a.m. I am out, and I didn't realize that I was very good at communication because I went back and I saw the treatment plans that had put through to patients and the number of patients who went ahead with treatment. That was close to 90 to 95%.
Yeah, terrific.
So, and yeah, and we are looking at treatment plans, which are like $60,000, $70,000. So I think I do that quite well. I found that I can train people. I can train people to do work to a very high standard. Mm-hmm. That was a revelation because I never thought of myself as a good teacher or a good communicator. So it was good to know that I could. I have trained my treatment coordinator in writing emails, teaching good communication skills. I've taught my DAs how to set up for full arch sterile theater work from scratch, and they do it quite well. And I've taught them to train other people. Mm. So I think that is probably the biggest thing that's come out of it.
What do you think people that want to scale up like you have need to understand or need to know about the process of scaling up that's perhaps not so well known?
The biggest thing is, as you said, you need to be able to train people to a high standard and test them. Mm. Not once and forget it, but frequently, because things change all the time. So unless and until you're willing to do that, which is sometimes feels like you're taking 2 steps back, because as I said, waking up at 5:30, coming here at 8 o'clock, ensuring, and I have done that for days just to see a dentist place implants for the whole day. Have I needed to do that all the time? No, but I will do it. And it's getting lesser and lesser. So we, as dentists, we often tie our value to the clinical work we produce.
Yeah.
The day we stop doing that and the day we think we are going to work today, but I'm not going to see a single patient, but I'm still, it's important for me to turn up, drive whatever X amount of hours I'm driving, be there for the full day, teach this, teach that, look at this stuff, but I'm not seeing a single patient is when you're ready to scale up. And that's a mental shift.
I heard an expression a little while ago that all progress begins with the death of an identity, which sounds a bit sad, sounds a bit gruesome. But I guess what I'm trying to explore there is that mental shift is shifting from being I'm a dentist who's self-employed to being I'm a business owner who happens to own a dental practice. Mm. Is that how you see it as well, like the identity, how you see yourself?
Yes. And for me, it was even more important because if I'm driving to a practice, I'm driving at least 3 hours. The thought of just turning up and seeing a single patient for that entire, because I would be like, oh, let me just do this consult. I'll just sneak that in because I'm here. I may as well do that. For the practice as well, for the staff to see. One day I was like, you know, let's give these 3 implants to the associate. And they were like, well, you can do it in 5 minutes. And I said, that's not the point.
No.
So for them now to come to me and say, hey, look, let's do these wisdom teeth and then they can do this and then you can be here just in case is a big shift for them as well. So it's not just your identity shift. The practice needs to shift with you.
Yes.
And they do understand that we are all growing together. But I think it also starts from one single identity death. And that death that you don't, as humans, we like to please everybody.
Yes.
And that gives you more pleasure when a patient says, I want to see Vandana. but for me to say, look, I am not the best person for this job. This is. And when you get a 5-star review saying that, you know, I used to see Vandana for years, but now I'm seeing Aditya and he's wonderful. And when you take pleasure in that, that's when you can be a business owner, not until then.
So, ladies and gents, there's some really, really important discussion just to be had there because there's a role shift, there's an identity shift, and the identity shift happens before the role shift. But the role will become, instead of being the person who does the dentistry, you become the person that builds the team that does the dentistry. You build and lead and train that team to support the patients on your behalf. So, again, really key. Now, Vandana, one last question about tactics for a second, because one of the things about scaling up is I've often believed that when you scale a dental practice or indeed scale any business, what scales fast is mess and chaos, right? Confusion, complexity, all that sort of stuff. How have you managed to avoid excessive amounts of complexity, excessive amounts of confusion? How have you kept things simple and scalable? What degree of systemization have you got? How much is enough? How much is too little? How much is too much?
I'm not a big fan of complexity. I like things simple, predictable, and clear. So when we scaled up, obviously, COVID was the biggest factor. And we found that there was a significant amount of need in the area for full arch implant work.
Yep.
For 2 years, we only scaled up in that area. Nothing else.
Yeah,
so everything else was simple, basic, general dentistry. But we were a full arch implant practice. We were advertising heavily for general dentistry and full arch implant. That's it. There was no orthodontics. There was no cosmetic dentistry. There was no veneers, nothing at all. So the only two types of people who came into the practice were either looking for implant work or they were a family practice.
Yeah,
so it was easy to scale up that way. When we kind of figured out the workflow, the laboratories that were able to consistently deliver to a regional practice, all the other paraphernalia that went with it, because we have a general anesthetic theater which runs twice a week. The registered nurses, the anesthetic team, the blood work, everything was, all the consent forms, everything was figured out to the letter. That's when we introduced clear aligners and cosmetics, and then had a workflow for that. So I think that's now progressively getting better and better. And there's somewhere in the middle, we introduced a treatment coordinator so that they take over this role as well. And I think now we are at a stage where we can introduce orthodontics, fixed braces, and all the other bits and pieces, which I'm not very well aware of that come with it. But it's basically taking one thing, making sure you do it so well that you can do it with your eyes closed.
Yeah. So just on that, ladies and gents, one of the things we talk about is build out your workflow. So map each step of the treatment procedure. If it's, I'm just making it up, ortho, you're going to have your records, you're going to do your case presentation, you might put separators in, you know, whatever else, right? All that sort of stuff. You want to know each step, who's doing each step. You want to have the appropriate systems and protocols for each of those steps. If there's any training required for each of those steps, any list of instrumentation, so on. So as you map out your workflow, that's how to do it. We spoke off air about the mindset, about why some people achieve more than others. People who have been given the same degree of opportunity, the same resources, the same environment, so on and so forth. And I'm curious to ask you, in your experience, what separates people that achieve a lot compared to those that don't?
I think the biggest thing is there's actually three things, and I've seen it not just in myself or people who've succeeded, but also in associates who've succeeded.
Yep.
One is they don't skip steps. So they will understand that in order to achieve greatness, there is a lot of building blocks that have to be followed through. And they will do each building block properly in their own timeline and get to where they need to be properly. But that's once they get there, it's stable and it's consistent.
Yeah.
It's not fluke, it's not luck. It's a calculated way of progressing.
Yes.
So obviously we all make errors and we get here and there, but there is calculations that have to be made. There has to be building blocks that have to be done.
Yep.
So I think that's one thing. I will not compromise on any building block. If I have to do something, I will do it properly.
Yep.
Otherwise, I won't do it. So it's as I said, it's as simple as getting up at 5:30 if I have to, which I will, and then traveling for that X amount of time so that I'm here for my first patient, sometimes at 7 a.m. So our surgical facility opens at 7 a.m. The other thing is the ability to put in the hard work consistently over time.
Yeah.
Yes. It's not something that you can do today and you can't do tomorrow. So you need to have a good hard look at yourself and see whether you're able to do that. Again, as I said, it's very easy to say that the associate's been there for 10 years and he's booked out six months in advance and this and that. But no one's looking at the fact that he has turned up at the same practice day in and day out at 8:15 and left at 5:30 with all his notes complete, everything tidied up, everything done to really good perfection, planned for the next day, and then repeated it year on year for 10 years. So the same thing, when we do surgeries, we start at 6:30, we start at 7. We do fixed final teeth, so we don't finish at 9 p.m. some days.
Yep.
So we've done it, and it's one of those things. If you don't do it consistently, and it's not one day, it's consistently over a period of time that delivers results. So that is another mindset, I think.
100%.
I think the final thing that differentiates everybody who achieves success as opposed to people who are sort of not that successful in certain areas is that they take feedback quite well and they act on. And the same applies to me. I have received quite critical feedback from my mentors when I've done but I haven't shied away from it. I've taken it on board and I've improved. And the same thing, the dentists who have been given feedback that, look, it's this is how it needs to be done. If you do it this way, you'll get better results. They do tend to get good results in a shorter period of time, as opposed to people who don't take that feedback on.
Yeah.
So I think these are the three critical things. And I mean, you can make it as complicated as you want.
No, I think simple's good. I think simple's great. It's simple, but not easy. That's the thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So simple to understand. So there's building blocks. Don't skip steps. You know, do the right things in the right sequence. Don't skip a step. There's being able to do the hard work consistently for time over an extended period of time, like your associate's done. And then there's the ability to receive that feedback and see it as a gift and use it as an improvement tool rather than taking it personally or feeling hurt by it. You just go, okay, where do I need to get better? And so on and so forth. So I think that's absolutely gold. And I think that's true as well. I think that there's so many things in there that, you know, really do separate the people who achieve really high levels and those that achieve more modest amounts. And so I just want to say thank you for sharing that. Vandana, you've been incredibly generous with your time today. There's some real pearls of wisdom. And this is like a case study. This is like a roadmap of how to scale up. So for anyone listening who, you know, you want to either increase your income, have more time, and more enjoyment, then just follow the steps that Vandana has laid out there for you, because if you do that, you'll get the results. But you've got to, you know, you just not skip a step, put the building blocks in place. You've got to do the hard work over time, and you've got to get that feedback and adjust as you go. So I think those 3 points that Vandana mentioned at the end are going to be your friend, as well as all the other bits and pieces that she shared. So, Vandana, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for that, Jesse. I will see you in January.
Look forward
and
to it.
I'll be honest with you. A lot of the insight has come from the Practice Max session that I attended over November, because it allows you to take all of the information that you've had and kind of put it into little tables. Mm. You've got one table after the other table, and you can kind of navigate yourself. So it helps a lot with that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate those kind words. That's lovely.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.